The Metal AI Podcast.
Hello, I'm Dr. Felix Beecher, and this is the Medical AI Podcast, a 30-minute thrill ride of big ideas. We talk to a range of top guests, from industry innovators to scientists to philosophers. This is brought to you by Omdia and Informatech, where I'm the head of healthcare technology. Medical AI might seem like a really new field. For example, the first medical AI product approved by the FDA was done so in only 2017. However, does medical AI actually have a history that is longer and richer than we might think? And are there important lessons to be learnt from that history? To explore this, it's a privilege to once again have as my guest somebody who has had a long and illustrious career in medicine and who has closely followed medical AI since the early days. He's an old friend of the podcast, Professor Mark Braunstein. He is Emeritus Professor at Georgia Tech, visiting scientist at CSIRO's Australian eHealth Research Centre, and author of Health Informatics on Fire, and he's an all-round towering intellectual and good egg. Mark, a very, very big welcome back.
Thank you, Felix, for the overly kind introduction, but I'll take it.
Kind, but not overly, I would say. Anyway, look, let's start with, let's go back a few years, Mark. What was the background to the development of medical AI, would you say?
Well, for medical AI to be developed and certainly for it to be used, there had to be a healthcare computing field for it to plug into and for it to obtain data from. So that field dates to the 1960s at least. As we discussed in the first episode, the industry has been very slow to adopt the use of IT in medical practice. That's kind of interesting because revenue generating technology such as imaging advanced enormously during the decades of the 70s and 80s and 90s when health IT was relatively slow to be adopted. And I think at least here in the United States, the original use case was charge capture. Making sure that all the things that got done in the hospital ended up on someone's bill. But the real goal of the field is improving care quality, and frankly, there wasn't much of a market for that until the United States started moving to a new approach to payment, which rewards quality and efficiency. And this has clearly, along with federal policies, driven adoption. And that has attracted major tech companies to the field. So today, Google, Microsoft, Amazon, Apple, and I guess all of the other major tech companies are involved to one degree or another in health IT. And of course, these are the companies, either alone or through investments, that have led to the modern artificial intelligence that people are so excited about these days. Now, the previous attempts at AI in healthcare and in general typically rested on the development of human-derived rules. And there are several reasons for that. First of all, there were no stores of digital data that could be used to derive relationships between data and whatever predictions one was interested in making. Computer performance wasn't up to the task anyway, and we hadn't yet developed the modern AI and machine learning techniques such as neural networks. But in healthcare, there were some early efforts. The HELP system, developed by Dr. Homer Warner in Utah, was an expert system He impaneled experts to develop rules in their field for use in the system. And it was built into an electronic medical record system in the hospital. And that integration with the system meant it was used successfully for many decades. Another example was Meissen. It used scientific rules for antibiotic selection. And even though it was judged by experts to equal the performance of humans, it was never used in patient care because back then, this is the 1970s, there was skepticism about computers making medical decisions. And because physicians were not using digital records, using it meant going to a computer, re-entering data that had already been written in the chart, outside of the physician's normal workflow and process. And that often took as much as 30 minutes, which is a lot of time for a practicing physician. The one example of early AI in medicine that uses approaches that would today be recognized as AI was Internist, developed by Jack Myers and Harry Popple at the University of Pittsburgh. And Internist was also successful technically, but not in terms of being used. The training was quite lengthy. The user interface was unwieldy. As in the case of Meissen, it took, in the case of Internist, 30 to 90 minutes to do a consultation. And the original version went down some pretty unlikely paths, unlikely clinically. There was a later version in Internist 2 that attempted to fix that, but it was also never used in clinical practice on any broad scale.
Okay, so you said that medicine is being notably slow to adopt computer technology. Why do you think that is?
Part of it is the people that go into medicine are generally not particularly interested in technology. And I don't know that that's as true today as it once was. But there was sort of a natural selection of students in college and maybe before. And those who were technologically adept didn't go to medicine. And, there was also a lack of incentives, as I said. Why use it? When the only benefit was the prospect, and I emphasize prospect, that the unproven prospect that it would improve the quality of patient care. There were certainly people early on who believed it would. In addition to the people I mentioned, Dr. Larry Weed, who developed the subjective objective assessment plan approach to charting, the SOAP note, believed it. And I guess I was one of the people who believed it, as was the chairman of the early family medicine training program where I worked in the late 1960s.
Okay, so let's take you back in terms of your personal story. How did your personal interest in AI start?
Well, it goes back to my undergraduate days at MIT. In the late 60s, or actually the mid 60s. I graduated in 1965. It was a hot topic on campus. I personally got exposed through a course I took to the debate between Harvard's B.F. Skinner and Noam Chomsky, MIT's Noam Chomsky's arguments about the nature of natural language. Skinner argued that language is learned, entirely learned. Babies are not born with natural language skills, I guess is the word. They learn them. Chomsky argued that it was innate, that we are in fact born with a certain degree of grammar, you know, built into our brain, and there are certainly similarities among all human languages that suggested that might be true. The debate's never been totally resolved, but Chomsky's theory of a universal grammar is widely accepted in the field of linguistics these days, and that was his field. AI itself was a hot topic at MIT. fueled, I guess, as much as anything by the development of a program called ELISA by Dr. Joseph Weizenbaum at MIT. And ELISA was arguably the first chatbot. It could do anything that you wanted to do with a chatbot, but there was a particularly interesting version that simulated a therapist. So you could sit at a computer terminal and type in questions and interact with ELISA, the therapist. There's no question it gave the illusion of understanding. I myself was just fascinated. I spent hours interacting with it. But the approach that was used wouldn't, I think, today be considered artificial intelligence. There was really no framework for contextualizing events. It just was a set of clever rules based upon what you typed in to tell it how to respond.
Right. And I guess ELISA was probably, correct me if I'm wrong, it's certainly the first famous attempt, at least that I'm aware of trying to pass the Turing test. Is that fair?
I guess. I don't know if that was Weizenbaum's overt objective, but I think it probably is fair. Before we move on to that, I would say that ELISA is available online. You can Google NGIT for New Jersey Institute of Technology ELISA chatbot, and you can get to it. And you can experience what it was like to interact with a chatbot with what was artificial intelligence of the day back in the 1960s.
Yeah, right. I know you're right. The chatbot was not intended as something that could pass a Turing test, but it was nonetheless the first famous chatbot. And apparently, what I've read is that people were actually genuinely fooled by ELISA, which I find hard to believe because I've chatted to it as well. And my experience was that you tend to go down blind alleys pretty quickly. Is that how you found it?
Yeah, but people were fooled.
I think probably people are less naive now about chatbots, and I think it'd be much...
Well, that's true. No question. But before we leave that discussion, there is a common thread here between Chomsky, Skinner, and ELISA, and that is that artificial intelligence and natural language are closely related. And certainly we're seeing that today with ChatGPT and what has stunned and fascinated millions of people is its ability to produce natural language that is increasingly difficult to distinguish between something that a human being would do, which leads us to the Turing test that you mentioned earlier.
Let's pause a second and explore that a bit more, because I think from the point of view of a programmer in the 60s, computer programming deals typically with logical statements like ifs and thens. And I guess an awful lot of diagnosis and treatment can be done on the basis of very simple if-then statement or if-then logical points, right? In principle, at least. And I guess that must have been attractive to people trying to develop medical computer systems.
Yes. And in fact, it worked, as we've discussed, it worked quite well. But the key is it worked as well as humans. And humans were using the same rules that were programmed into the AI. Perhaps the only difference is the AI didn't make mistakes, and it looked at everything that it was programmed to look at. And humans may not always do that. The key difference is today, AI is discovering the rules. It's discovering rules that people don't know about.
Right.
So when a neural network analyzes a vast store of data, it's discovering what the people in the field call factors, and they have a statistical correlation to whatever prediction you're trying to make. In the case of ChatGPT, the AI is trying to predict what the next word should be. The first time you hear that, that may sound a bit strange, but isn't that what human beings do? As I'm speaking, something in my brain is putting words together and making human intelligent decisions about what the next word should be. And obviously great writers do a superb job of that. I'm sorry, go ahead.
So before we leave the 60s then, could you just sort of describe how the field felt to you back then? What kind of ideas were being thrown around? Was it a time of optimism or pessimism?
Well, there was a raging debate. People knew this was a hard problem. I remember having many discussions with classmates, one in particular, about how difficult this was going to be. How long would it be before a computer, an artificial intelligence program, could pass the Turing test? So now we've mentioned it three times. I guess if it's okay, I'll explain what it is. It's actually very easy to explain. First of all, it was proposed by Alan Turing, the British polymath who was deeply involved in the decoding of the German code during World War II. And the issue he addressed was, how would you tell if a computer had achieved human intelligence? And his test was, well, if people talked to it and couldn't decide whether they were talking to another person or to a computer, then it had passed the test. And that was in the early 50s, so it was very well known when I was in school in the 60s. And it's a topic of great discussion. How hard would it be to do that, and how long would it take? And the field has, in fact, had many reboots in the ensuing period and has gone through alternating periods of optimism and disappointment, and various approaches have been tried.
Looking at the field as it is right now, would you consider the Turing test to have been passed?
Well, many people think that ChatGPT passes it. Now, there is argument about that, because as everyone who's following the field at all closely knows, ChatGPT makes mistakes, sometimes flagrant mistakes. But there's no question it produces stunningly good natural language. We're going to talk about that with respect to healthcare later. But I think there's a sense of disappointment, because there was probably an assumption way back when that if a computer could pass the Turing test, then it would in fact be sentient. It would have perception and feelings like people do, that it would be conscious, whatever that means, and intelligent, again, whatever that means, like humans. And I don't think it's possible to argue that ChatGPT has any of those things, and its developers don't feel that it has any of those things. Right. So I guess the question today is, do we need a new test? And exactly what might it be?
Well, have you heard of the Wozniak test, Mark?
I've heard of it, but I don't actually recall what it is now.
Well, the Wozniak test, I think, is brilliant. It comes from Steve Wozniak, one of the founders of Apple. And that is that a machine should be able to go into the average American kitchen and be told to make a cup of coffee and just be able to find all the ingredients, be able to fill up the kettle and find a mug and pour the kettle into the mug and just make a cup of coffee like you or I could do, which I think is obviously a completely different way of thinking about artificial intelligence, right? And I suspect that I tend to agree. I think ChatGPT has shown that the Turing test is basically now solved. I think we are probably a long way away from having the Wozniak test solved, but maybe I'm wrong.
To me, it feels quite real, and I think many people would agree. But another way of stating the goal, I sort of mentioned sentience and consciousness and human-like intelligence earlier, is a term that's used in the field, artificial general intelligence. It's always abbreviated AGI. Mm-hmm. And that would mean computers can solve any problem. And you've just pose one making coffee. And they can understand, interpret, and act in a way that is indistinguishable from a human. And I think Wozniak is using the coffee example to essentially illustrate this definition of artificial general intelligence. It's hard to know how long it'll take to get there, although there are people predicting 2030 or 2040. 2030 is quite a bold prediction, but I don't know. I mean, we'll, given the accelerated rate of development and the enormous amount of resources and money that's now pouring into the field, and you see there's a business case for it, as we all see, as Google is concerned that it might lose its $135 billion a year search business to a chat box enabled version of Microsoft Bing.
Right.
So there's a strong business case for investing in it. But sitting behind all of that is the fact that we really don't understand human intelligence. And for those interested in that comment, I'm going to recommend another document on the web, or another web resource, Baron Milledge's blog. He's a postdoc at Oxford University. And the blog is called The Scale of the Brain versus Machine Learning. And it's at his site, Baron, BEREN.io. And he goes into interesting and significant detail about the human brain and how it works, and as a way of thinking about how artificial and general intelligence might have to work.
Okay, so staying in the early days, did you ever have some kind of powerful revelatory moment when you thought, wow, medical AI could be really powerful?
Well, I must confess that in the 1960s, I was convinced this was going to happen. Now, that wasn't with respect to medicine. It was just with respect to AI in general. And if you pinned me down and said, well, why did you feel that way? I it's hard for me to actually say, because I understood what Eliza was and what Eliza wasn't. And I was very involved in the Skinner-Chomsky debate, not as an active participant, but in reading about it and thinking about it. But I just believed it would eventually happen. Within medicine, I guess the aha moment was a visit I made to Salt Lake City to see how Dr. Homer Warner was developing the HELP system. Of course, this was knowledge engineering, but at the time, that was thought to be the path to AI. And seemed clear to me that he was going to be able to do what he set out to do, and he did. That was a sort of an aha moment.
I know this is probably a ridiculously unfair question, but can you kind of give a brief overview of how you think the field has changed since the 60s, bringing us up to the present?
We now have the things that I listed earlier that we didn't have. We have vast stores of digital data. If your goal is a general artificial intelligence, the internet is, I guess, the perfect data resource, because it's almost impossible to think of anything that isn't out there on the internet. If your goal is patient care, It's the vast stores of digital patient records that are beginning to accumulate now that electronic medical record systems are essentially universal here in the United States and are becoming universal in more and more places. So we have the data, and we have the techniques for analyzing data, discovering factors in that data, and being able to make accurate predictions. And that's just getting better and better. It's already incorporated into so many products and services. We just take it for granted. I can remember when speech recognition was a difficult problem. And now we take it for granted. I mean, it's built into everything around us. We don't think anything of talking to our phone or to inexpensive devices that control our lights or the heating and air in our homes or what have you, and expecting that they'll understand what we say and they'll respond accordingly. And as I said earlier, the field is attracting massive investments, the most notable of which is Microsoft's very recent $10 billion, that's with a B, dollar investment into OpenAI, the company that developed ChatGPT.
Let's think just about the present now. What impresses you most about all of the recent developments in medical AI? Which ones would you pick out as being especially important?
The real aha moment for me about AI and its role in biology and medicine, but I suppose it's equally applicable to AI in general, was that the DeepMind tool developed, or the AlphaFold tool developed by DeepMind, which is part of Alphabet, the parent company to Google, in 2020, solved the protein folding problem. Now, it's important to understand what the problem is. Proteins, which are ubiquitous in living organisms and are responsible for most of the activities that take place in living organisms, consist of a sequence of amino acids and will predictably fold into a certain shape under certain conditions. So the human body has predictable pH and temperature and this sort of thing, and our proteins will fold into predictable shapes. Those shapes are absolutely critical. If you get interested in molecular biology and read about it, you realize that the shape of proteins determines what they can do. And there are proteins whose shape is complex almost beyond imagination. I'll give you my favorite example. I hope this isn't beyond the audience. I, as you know, the genetic instructions for creating you and me and Felix are contained within our DNA, a molecule that consists of four nucleotides in a famously twin folding structure. DNA gets replicated when cells divide, and sometimes mistakes are made. And those mistakes can have serious consequences. There is an incredibly complicated protein, I forget its name, if I had realized I was going to go down this road, I would have looked it up, that actually travels down DNA as it's reproducing and can find and repair errors. Literally take out the erroneous nucleotide and replace it with the correct nucleotide. Stop and think about that a moment. I mean, it's when I first became aware of it, when I actually took a molecular biology course at Georgia Tech, audited it at least, it just was beyond my comprehension. Well, anyway, so the problem for years has been, how do we know what that shape is? Well, that you can determine the shape of proteins through X-ray crystallography, but it's an expensive, complicated process, and there are lots of proteins out there. And there have been efforts over the years to, can we somehow predict the shape of the protein once we know its sequence, its amino acid sequence? Well, DeepMind's AlphaFold largely solved that problem. And to give you an idea, a report about all this in Nature, a prestigious journal, quotes a famous scientist in the field. This is a direct quote, as this will change medicine It will change research. It will change bioengineering. It will change everything. So here we have a computer program doing something with profound impact on medicine, bioengineering, biology, and, quote, everything. It doesn't get more impressive than that, at least in my worldview.
Right. And I think, but there's a paradox here as well, I think, which is that that's all true, but nobody understands how. In other words, the problem is solved, but nobody really understands the solution. The computer engineers can't tell you anything about it. Nobody can really plumb the depths of the trained algorithm. The biologists are probably none the wiser as well. That's fascinating, isn't it?
Yes. And this is all done from using deep learning, which extracts features from raw data using something called neural networks, which at a very simplistic level, and I'm not able to go beyond a fairly simplistic level, mimics the human brain. There are nodes in these neural networks that process inputs and can signal nodes connected to them based on the results of that processing, which is thought to be the way the brain works. The nodes in the brain are neurons, and they have synapses that interconnect neurons with other neurons. And based on their processing of inputs, they signal those other neurons through neurotransmitter chemicals. Deep learning networks have multiple layers. To give an example, in an imaging processing neural network, the lower layers may identify edges in whatever shape they're being presented with, whereas the higher layers may actually identify concepts that are meaningful to humans, such as digits, letters, or faces. And as you've sort of telescoped, the problem here is we don't actually understand how they work. Of course, we don't understand how the brain works either, but they are comparable in performance and in some cases surpass human expert performance, which is suggestive, of course, that neural networks are in fact mimicking what goes on in the brain, but we don't know that for sure. And I'll give a quick example here, a program called Dr. AI, developed by a former colleague of mine at Georgia Tech, Dr. Jiming Sun, who's one of the more serious researchers in the field of medical AI. And the goal of Dr. AI is to predict a patient's diagnosis and medication based on subsequent visits, and it uses a recurrent neural network. And in a study of over 250,000 patients from over 2,000 physicians who were cared for over 8 years, it got 64% of the future diagnoses correctly if you limited it to 10 diagnoses, and almost 80% if you allowed it to have 30 diagnoses. So these tools, as I said, are mimicking human performance. And then I'll conclude this maybe overly lengthy part of the discussion by talking about GPT-3, which is the engine that powers ChatGPT. ChatGPT is just a program, a human interface. The real work is being done by a program called GPT-3. It's what's called a transformer type of a neural network. And its goal is to predict the next word from a set of words given a context. It was trained on, as I understand it, data from the internet. It has 175 billion parameters, which I think equate to nodes that I described earlier. It has 96 layers. I'm sorry, the parameters are the weights and biases of the nodes in his 96 layers. 10 times more than any previous model, so it's quite an accomplishment.
Let's talk about the future then, because I think what you've given is a is a fantastically interesting account of where things were in the 50s, where things are now. The difference is kind of astonishing, right? And so let's try and think about the future, maybe the next 20 or maybe the next 30 years. How do you see that future unfolding?
I don't know that anyone has an accurate crystal ball that far out. And
That's why I only ask this question to the brightest of minds.
And I certainly don't claim to have one. So I will cheat a bit and say, I'll talk about general directions. I'm not going to make a prediction about when we'll see artificial general intelligence, when a computer will be viewed as sentient. And there are people who, frankly, don't believe that's ever going to happen. We'll see.
Well, it's difficult to even imagine how it could be tested. I mean, I think this is a basic problem for that.
Well,
too,
instead of us testing the computer, maybe it'll test us. Then we'll know. I mean, there are all sorts of predictions. I mean, I think some of them are wild. I really don't think we're going to see the day when computers take over the world and decide that they don't really need dumb humans and get rid of us. But on the other hand, I don't think I would have thought 5 years ago that we would be seeing what ChatGPT is doing so soon. I mean, I certainly thought we would see it, but I didn't think we'd see it as soon as we're seeing it. So let's talk a bit about healthcare. Well, as we know, here I do have to refer to episode one, and I apologize to people who haven't listened to it, but we've seen in episode one that artificial intelligence is producing clinical documents and summaries at near human expert level. And I mentioned in the earlier episode a company called Abstractive Health, a new company here in New York based on work that was done at Cornell Tech, which is not very far from where I'm speaking to you today. Now, think about that a minute. The Abstractive Health system can summarize a medical record, a technically complex document, and summarize it about as well as a human can. And I gave an example in episode one where a discharge summary, the summary of what has taken place while a patient was in the hospital, in this case, a fairly complicated patient, something that physicians are required to produce so that the people who see the patient next don't have to read the chart to get a sense of what went on. And they're certainly not going to generally do that for lack of time. I have to digress here and say physicians hate doing discharge summaries. In fact, for some reason, it just popped in my head. I remember when I was doing a residency at Washington University in St. Louis, if we hadn't done our discharge summaries, our paycheck got held up. That was the way they made sure we did them. So we're starting to see really interesting and potentially significant applications in patient care. Another one I would point to is the less well-known and although I guess it's getting pretty well known, DALL-E, DALL-E2, which is the image processing output of the OpenAI, same company that produced GPT-3. And it's easy to imagine that a tool like that could be used by, let's say, plastic surgeons to show patients what they would look like after a proposed procedure. There are many other visual use cases in medicine. ChatGPT, in your conversation with it, suggested yet another use case, drug discovery, by analyzing vast amounts of scientific literature to find new targets and to generate new hypotheses. And one that is close to my mind is the ability to use this technology to more accurately triage patients and to personalize our interactions with them. Historically, patients with a given medical problem were given the same information. We now understand through research and the understanding we have about the role that genomics play and other factors play that two patients, and cancer is always the best example, two patients with, quote, the same cancer really don't have the same cancer because they have their genomic differences, and we're starting to employ genomic technologies to personalize and individualize their treatment and match them to new drugs that will work in their case because of their genomic makeup, whereas they might not work in another patient with, quote, the same cancer. I think we're going to see more and more personalization of healthcare through these technologies. They're going to also be very valuable in things like medication management and mundane things like appointment scheduling. And we're starting to see all of that. I do want to recall, though, your conversation with ChatGPT, who said that we're still in the very early stages of applying it to healthcare. Mm-hmm. And we should always keep in mind the inherent limitations of these models and to be cautious about drawing conclusions from their outputs without proper validation and clinical context. So I want to focus on that for a moment. This issue of clinical context. This is something that great physicians do well. They maybe subconsciously to a bit even can put each patient into the proper clinical context, draw the right conclusions, and prescribe the right treatments. Dr. Shortlift, the developer of Mycin, when I talked to him about Mycin and artificial intelligence, said that we need to recognize that these artificial intelligence tools lack domain knowledge, which is slightly different than clinical context. But put them together, and when we get to the essence of what skills clinicians have, they have a great deal of domain knowledge and experience, which allow them to put each patient into the proper clinical context. So how might that be overcome as artificial intelligence is applied to medicine? And here I get back to the FHIR technology, which certainly offers an approach to connecting technologies.
By the way, just to clarify, when we say FHIR, we're talking about FHIR, not lighters or sticks.
We discussed that in the last episode. Mm-hmm. We haven't mentioned it in this episode, but it provides a vehicle for connecting tools to electronic records, exploiting the data they contain for various purposes. And in this context, it provides a vehicle to allow artificial intelligence tools to understand the clinical context, or at least the data that leads to an understanding of the clinical context of an individual patient. So I'm very optimistic that these tools will avoid, to some degree or another, the problems that ChatGPT predicted when they are properly incorporated into each individual patient's record, and they can personalize decisions and advice.
Mark, if you got a phone call tomorrow and it was President Joe Biden and he invited you to the White House to give him one piece of advice on translating all of these amazing developments recently into actual clinical practice, what would that one piece of advice be?
First of all, I would congratulate President Biden since he was in the Obama administration, for the evolution and the development and the deployment of federal policies that have led to where we are today in healthcare in the United States, where digital records, with all their limitations and problems, are used virtually everywhere, and where we've recognized the importance of and the key role of having a standard for interacting with those records. And that's what the Fast Healthcare Interoperability Resources, or FHIR technology, is about. The one thing that could be added to the mix, in my view, and there are efforts underway now to do this, is making the domain knowledge. Notice I talked about the clinical context and how FHIR could help with clinical context, because tools could be connected to each patient's record and understand their context. But Ted Shortliff worried about domain knowledge. And how do we give these tools domain knowledge? Well, there is an effort underway. It's still early, and it's a big effort and a complicated effort, and maybe the federal government can help to develop extensions to the FHIR technology so that medical knowledge itself, the literature in the journals, clinical trials, could be represented digitally in a computable form. So now a hypothetical artificial intelligence clinical tool could look at a patient's record and look at the entirety of medical knowledge as represented in the research literature and the entirety of clinical trials and potentially zero in on what would most benefit this patient, both in terms of treatment and registration into appropriate clinical trials. I can't overstate the importance of that. Only 5% of cancer patients today are in a clinical trial. And part of the reason is it's so naggingly hard to plow through the posted literature on clinical trials and identify whether the patient in front of you actually qualifies for any of them, and if so, which ones.
That's a great answer. Mark, I want to extend to you a huge thank you. It's been a fascinating whirlwind whistle-stop tour of the modern landscape of medical AI. So thank you very much indeed.
Well, thank you for having me.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you. Bye-bye. Thank you for listening. I'm Felix Beecher. Ping me on LinkedIn for more information on Omdia's services in healthcare technology. See you next time.